Now that morning, the morning of January 18, 2020, the defendant got into his car, a VW Jetta, and he drove north up the I-17 past Flagstaff and then turned towards the east, toward New Mexico. Eventually, he arrived in the town of Farmington, New Mexico. Now, this was a Saturday. It was the defendant's day off, and yet he chose that day to drive 7 hours to an obscure community on the eastern edge of Farmington, New Mexico, the place where Sasha lived, the Lamp and Light community.
Meanwhile, 27-year-old Sasha Kraus was having a typical Saturday where she lived in Farmington, New Mexico. She was shopping and running some errands. Around 7:30 p.m., she got into her car and drove to her local Mennonite church to pick up some books. But she would never make it back home.
And what happened when Sasha got to the church is not entirely clear. But what will be clear is that the defendant was there, that he abducted Sasha, put her in his car, and then drove hours away to the area of the Sunset Crater National Monument.
There were no witnesses who saw what happened to Sasha Kraus. Months later, there would be an arrest, and then the following year, a trial.
At some point, the defendant duct taped Sasha's wrist together in front of her. He bashed her head so hard that it caused skull fractures. And then he pulled out his .22 caliber rifle. He pointed it at the back of her head and fired one shot, killing her.
But not so fast, said the defense.
Appreciate this. The evidence bullet, the smashed bullet, the damaged bullet, the recovered bullet from the autopsy did not come from the seized ammunition when the gun was recovered. Holy smoke. Why don't we hear about that from the state?
This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 184. On January 18th, 2020, the San Juan County Sheriff's Office in New Mexico received a report of a missing person. Detective Steve Strang was on the scene to investigate. Sasha Kraus's car was at the church, but there was no sign of Sasha. Detective Strang looked for signs of foul play in the immediate area.
The vehicle was approximately three parking lot widths. Again, these are not marked parking lot spaces, so approximately three vehicle widths from where there would be a sidewalk leading up to the door of the church. So in observation there, I'm looking in the gravel, looking around for either what we would consider a sign of struggle, either in the terrain or items that may have been left behind during a struggle, articles of clothing, things that someone may have been carrying, and so on.
He saw nothing in the parking area near Sasha's car that pointed to anything suspicious. He then looked inside the church.
And was there anything that stood out to you, any signs of struggle or anything that seemed out of place?
There were not. The church was very neat and orderly.
Detective Strang then went back and looked inside Sasha's car.
The thing that stood out to me when we were looking in the vehicle is that the keys were between the rocker panel, if you will, and the passenger side seat. So it appeared as if the keys...
Let's go back. Just define a couple of things for us. The rocker panel is what?
So when you get into the car and you're sitting on the floor and the door closes, where the bottom of the door would rest.
Okay. And the keys were between that and the passenger side seat?
Correct.
And we're talking about the front passenger, right?
Correct.
Okay. Anything else inside the car that you noted initially that was interesting?
Nothing that appeared to be out of the ordinary, no.
Okay.
Detective Strang then decided to go over to where Sasha lived, an area called the Lighthouse.
The building references a lighthouse is a gray or blue in color building. It's approximately 200 or 250 yards from the church building where the vehicle was located. We did go up to that building to make observation.
At any point, were you given a description of what Sasha may have been wearing at the time?
Yes. Initially, upon seeing and trying to gather some immediate information, I was told that Sasha was wearing a long gray in color dress. And I was also told that initially, as they were looking for her, they realized that Sasha's jacket, white in color, was missing from her bedroom.
Inside Sasha's bedroom, was there anything that stood out, anything that suggested that she was taken from the room or that she would plan on leaving the room?
No. When we were looking through the room, again, was very neat and orderly. Upon observation, we did notice that her purse was on the bed, leading me to believe that she didn't plan on leaving for a long extended period of time.
The San Juan County Sheriff's Office began searching for Sasha with no concrete leads. Then, just over a month later, on February 22nd, 2020, a call came in to the Coconino County Sheriff's Office in Arizona, just outside Flagstaff. The body of a woman had been discovered near the Sunset Volcano Crater National Monument area. Detective Lauren Nagel was the lead investigator.
She was lying face down. Her body was up against some shrubs or some small bushes, and I couldn't see her hands. I couldn't see her face. She was face down. Something I immediately noticed was the way she was dressed. So I noticed that she was wearing a long dress and that her hair was up in a tight bun.
Now, we heard from now Detective Luna, he was at the time Patrolman Luna, that this area is just cinders on the ground. Is that your recollection?
It is.
And does that prevent what could otherwise have been easy to identify footsteps in the area?
Yes. So that's something I also noted on scene. When I was walked in by Deputy Luna, and this is common when we respond to crime scenes, we try to take the same path in and out. I was told that responding officers had walked the perimeter of the scene, which is also common, just to check for maybe other people in the area or any sort of danger to officers. So as we walked in, I noticed their footpath, but you can't see footprints because it's basically little rocks. And so you'll see indents, but not prints in it.
She began to photograph the scene. She took photos of the remains, noting the clothes. She said the victim wasn't dressed like someone who was going hiking. She also noticed something about the victim's hands.
This is a photo that I took of the midsection of her body, and the focus of the photo is her hands, which were bound by duct tape.
At first, she wasn't sure who the victim was, but she remembered seeing the missing bulletin about Sasha Kraus. Because of the way the victim was dressed, it made her think it could be her. She called San Juan County and cross-checked their investigation with hers.
We met with San Juan County Sheriff's Office right away. So they were able to fill us in on their investigation up until that point. I sort of began with looking at everything they had done, kind of a second set of eyes on everything they had done, to include watching interviews that they had conducted, reading reports, reviewing cell phone records. They had already got Sasha's cell phone records by that point, and really just familiarizing myself with the case. I personally had never heard of a Mennonite before this case. And so a lot of that time was also spent talking with Sasha's family or people that knew her so that I could sort of understand that culture and try to develop leads from all of the information that I was overviewing.
Her victim was definitely Sasha. She said the media was closely following what was going on, and she received constant tips from the public. Part of her investigation was looking at the cell tower logs. There were now three locations she could check to see if there had been similar devices connected to all of them. The church, the location Sasha's phone lost signal, and where Sasha's body was discovered.
And the cell phone information from Sasha, as we heard from Seb Dishman, indicates that she was traveling, assuming she had that device with her, to the west around 7:45 and beyond. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. So in consultation with Mr. Dishman, did you determine that retrieving tower records or the data from the towers in that area would have been helpful?
Yes. So the reason why San Juan County Sheriff's Office hadn't gone that route yet was because up until my involvement, they really only had two locations. They had where Sasha had gone missing from and the area of Four Corners where her phone left the network. So once I became involved, we then had that third location where she had been found. And that's when the idea came up to do what we call tower dumps in those three locations to see if there was any common devices.
And we were talking about a tower. We're talking about a cell site. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And how many devices, unique devices, hit on all three of those towers?
Just one.
And whose was that?
That was Mark Gooch's device.
Mark Gooch was an Air Force airman stationed at the Luke Air Force Base in Phoenix. He was also a former member of the Mennonite Church back in Wisconsin, where he grew up. Mark spoke with Detective Nagel, who had to use a body cam to record the audio because the audio in the interrogation room wasn't working. She asked Mark if he knew why he had been brought in for an interview.
All right, so I always ask people this when I start an interview. What are you thinking right now? Do you have any ideas to why a detective with the sheriff's office would want to speak with you?
One thing I can think of is maybe I'll grab two guys in my pocket.
He told her the only thing he could think of is maybe he was driving too fast and had too many speeding violations. Then she asked him about his whereabouts for around the time Sasha went missing. Thanks to the phone records she had obtained, as well as a license plate reader, she already knew his phone and his car's locations for Saturday, January 18th, 2020. She knew he had traveled to near where Sasha went missing. She asked him if he had traveled anywhere after he had been stationed at Luke Air Force Base just a few months prior.
Yes, I've done quite a bit of traveling.
Okay, so tell me about that.
Just go hiking on the weekend.
He said he would just go hiking on the weekend. But he admitted to traveling to New Mexico and stopping in Flagstaff for gas in January, around the time Sasha had gone missing. Detective Nagel asked him why he was in Farmington. Mark said he was checking out the Mennonite church there. He said he wasn't currently a member, but he was thinking about going back. A friend of his had told him about the church in Farmington. Detective Nagel remarked that it was odd that he would travel 7 hours to find a church when there were others closer. She asked him what his childhood was like and if he had anything against the Mennonite church. She asked him if he had felt like an outsider growing up, and he shrugged it off. Detective Nagel then told him that she had noticed some discrepancies with what he was telling her in their interview versus what she already knows. For example, he had said he went hiking on the night Sasha disappeared, but estimated he had returned around 2 a.m. What if I told you that the time you came back that morning was 6:53 a.m., she asked. That's a long time. How do you explain that? Mark mumbled something and shrugged again.
I just want to slow down here because I can tell you're getting, you know, a little nervous or whatever, but again, all I ask is that you tell me the truth. All right, so if there's anything that before you kept from me that now is going to come out, now would be the time. So again, you saying that you came home at even 2 in the morning, almost 7 in the morning, that's almost five hour difference. So that's the biggest thing here I'm trying to figure out is if you went over to the compound, or I call it compound, the church, Farmington Church, it's odd to me that you drove all that way and you didn't talk to anybody or you just went, okay, they don't have church tonight, I'll just drive straight back. Because you wanted to get back for your hike the next morning, but then you end up coming through Luke Air Force Base at about 7. So that's what I'm trying to figure out here.
Perfect. I understand.
Okay.
Well, I probably stopped and slept a bit longer than I thought.
He said he had probably just stopped and slept in his vehicle longer than he had thought. She asked him if he had anything to do with the kidnapping and murder of Sasha Krause. He maintained that he did not. She then told him that another detective was speaking with his brother, Sam Gooch. It was at that moment Mark said he should get a lawyer, and the interview was over.
Sam's telling us himself. You're talking to me, and I want to just make sure what you goes on here. Lines up. And what I know a little bit about from Sam said is, sounds like something's going on here as far as, like, you may have hurt feelings against the Mennonite church or maybe a grudge or something like that.
So let me answer it.
The interview concluded, and Mark Gooch was charged with two counts of first-degree murder, kidnapping, and theft. In 2020, Sasha Kraus was living in a small Mennonite community in Farmington, New Mexico. She had just moved there from Texas. She produced religious texts and had a love of languages, speaking not only English, but Spanish and French. She loved to read books and occasionally taught Sunday school. In September 2021, prosecutor Eamon Barker told the jury about Sasha's upbringing in the Mennonite community and how she led a peaceful existence, an existence that was disrupted when Mark Gooch kidnapped her, he said, duct taping her wrists together, bashing her head, and shooting her with a .22-caliber weapon. Prosecutor Barker told the jury that Mark was no stranger to the Mennonite community, that he had grown up in it. But at this point in his life, he no longer believed in those tenets. In fact, Barker said he hated those tenets. Prosecutor Barker told the jury that a week before the murder, Mark left to go do surveillance on the Mennonites in Farmington. He said surveillance was a word that Mark had used in a text message to his brother Sam, saying, quote, "Even this morning surveillance was boring. Bunch of old people without much left to live for, and clearly not the Mennonite people we grew up with. Sad to say, another disappointment." According to Barker, Mark's resentment of the Mennonite community turned to violence on January 18, 2020. Sasha was missing for weeks. When an autopsy was performed on her body, it was discovered that she had suffered blunt force trauma and a gunshot wound to the head. Prosecutor Barker told the jury they have surveillance video, phone and location data, and financial statements that prove that Mark is the killer.
Now, if that wasn't enough, the defendant also admitted that he drove from Glendale to Farmington on January 18th. You see, after Detective Nagel obtained these cell phone records, she went to go speak to him at his base. And she asked him early in the interview if he had traveled outside of the state in the last 6 months. This was an interview done in April of last year. The defendant initially lied, said no. And then later in the interview, he admitted he had, in fact, driven to New Mexico on the date of Sasha's disappearance. Now, his explanation was that he was just going to attend a Mennonite church there. Another contradiction. He drove there on a Saturday, not on a Sunday when the services would have been held, never introduced himself to anyone in that community. And in fact, later in that same interview, he told Detective Nagel he had no intention of attending any Mennonite churches.
He said that on January 21st, Mark returned to the scene of the crime, where he had disposed of Sasha's body. He was there for about 30 minutes and then drove back. After Sasha's body was found, a press release was sent out, and Prosecutor Barker said the very next day, Mark contacted a friend of his and asked him to hold some personal items for him.
One of those items being a .22 caliber rifle, unbeknownst to the friend. And then the defendant went and got his car professionally detailed to the tune of $220.
Barker said that Mark deleted his location history from during the time when the murder occurred until after midnight on January 19th. He later deleted his entire location history.
Unfortunately for the defendant, deleting his Google account location history had no effect whatsoever on his AT&T location history retained by that provider. And in that sense, the defendant didn't cover his tracks. He highlighted them.
He told the jury that there was forensic evidence in the case, but he warned them that it's not like how it is on TV.
People don't leave DNA on everything they touch like an invisible trail. It can be removed. It can be cleaned off. If you're wearing gloves, that could prevent the passing of DNA. The same thing could be said for fingerprinting, which is notoriously difficult to find on firearms, for instance. Well, there were forensic scientists that examined Sasha's body, her clothing, and the duct tape. And ultimately, nothing was conclusive. But there was one piece of forensic evidence that was conclusive, the firearm evidence. As I mentioned, the defendant asked a friend to store his .22 caliber rifle shortly after the press release went out about finding Sasha's body. The police obtained that rifle. They sent it to the Department of Public Safety Crime Lab, where a forensic scientist with over 25 years of experience examined the markings on that rifle and compared it to the markings on the bullet taken from Sasha's neck. And it was a match. In other words, the defendant's rifle fired the fatal round to Sasha's head.
When Sam Gooch spoke with the police about his brother, he said that Mark had a grudge against the Mennonite church. But on the stand at Mark's trial, he walked that back a bit.
At the time, that was opinion and speculation. I can't 100% speak to how Mark may feel or think.
Sure. We're not asking you to get inside of his mind, but why would you say that he had a grudge at that time?
I don't recall my mindset at the time. That is what I said based on transcripts, but I can't necessarily know what I was thinking on why I would have said that at the time.
Would you tell him to let it go, let that grudge go?
If that were the case, yes.
Well, that's what you told the police you told him, right?
I believe so.
Did you tell him you can't blame them, the Mennonites, for how you grew up?
That sounds correct.
Prosecutor Barker asked why he would have said that if Mark hadn't told him he had a grudge. Sam replied that the way they grew up was different from many people.
It wasn't always easy for all of us. Each of us had different experiences and we took it different ways.
And is it your understanding that Mark Gooch did not have a positive experience in the Mennonite church?
You could say that.
I'm asking you what you could say.
That would be a question for Mark Gooch.
Did you have a positive experience with the Mennonites?
I hold no ill will towards the Mennonite group. That is part of my upbringing, and I accept it for what it is. But as I grew up, I made my own decisions in life and chose to move on towards from that.
Sam was a witness for the state of Arizona. He and Mark were close and spoke a lot, mostly through text messages. He said he and his brothers grew up in the Mennonite community in Wisconsin, but they weren't officially a part of the church.
What was your memory of that experience?
My memory of the experience would have been, it was easy to feel that we were less accepted into that culture, as since we were not necessarily born into it, not a multi-generational family that had been in that in the Mennonites for decades.
All right, so there wasn't a feeling of acceptance. Is that fair?
I think that's fair.
Right. Did that generate some negative feelings?
It could have.
It's a yes or no question for you.
For myself, it did at the time.
Okay.
He said there's a wide variety of beliefs within the Mennonite churches.
And what church was the one that you grew up in like?
It would have been more conservative.
You're familiar with the Lamp and Light Mennonite Church?
I am.
You are now. Probably not at the time you were living in Gleason, though, right?
No, I was not.
Okay. Would that, from what you know about the Lamp and Light community, is that similar to the community you grew up in?
I would expect it would be somewhat similar.
In other words, was it a conservative Mennonite church as opposed to something less conservative?
From what I know of it, it is.
Okay. And what is the distinction? How do we distinguish a conservative versus other types of Mennonites?
I'm no expert on Mennonites, but the easiest way is based on dress. You get further into it, beliefs and other such things.
All right. So technology, for instance, is technology something that if you're a conservative Mennonite, you're probably not having a smartphone, for instance. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Popular entertainment, that's not something that you would participate in, right?
Correct.
All right. And then the manner of dress, we've heard from Mennonites, as you might imagine in this case, about the head covering for women, the men are wearing plain shirts. Is that what you remember?
Yes, it is.
He was asked if he knew that Mark was surveilling Mennonites.
Based on that text message, which I took at face value, yes.
Okay. And a text message you're talking about, this was a message Mark sent to you about surveillance of Mennonites?
Correct.
Outside of that text message, did he talk to you about surveilling Mennonites?
No, he had expressed interest in looking for a church close by or attending a service, but never anything regarding surveillance.
When did he say he wanted to attend a church?
I can't put an exact time frame on it, but...
Was that in a text or a phone call?
That was over communication... That was when we talked over the computer.
Sam testified that he works in the IT field, that he installs and repairs phones and internet systems. Prosecutor Barker asked him to look over cell phone records between him and his brother Mark. He said there were no listed calls between them in December. But on January 18th, the day Sasha was killed, there were 6 calls. The first call was from Mark at 10:58 a.m. and lasted 25 minutes. Sam said he couldn't recall anything of substance from the conversation. Mark then called him at 12:06 p.m. for about 8 minutes. At 12:17 p.m., Mark called and they spoke for 3 minutes. At 1:19 p.m., he tried calling Mark, but it went unanswered. At 1:25 p.m., Mark called him and they spoke for a little over 33 minutes. Then, at 4:55 p.m., Mark called him and they spoke for more than 25 minutes.
So if we were to add up all that time, we're talking about over 90 minutes of phone conversation that day. Is that right?
That seems correct.
Okay. You don't remember anything from those conversations?
If something would have stood out, I believe I would recall that.
Do you know where he was when he made those calls?
I did not recall where he was.
Did he say anything about taking a trip that day?
Not that I can remember.
The next morning, Sam sent a text message to Mark that said, "Where are you at by now?"
Where are you at by now? What were you talking about?
I can't remember the circumstances surrounding that text. I can only take it at face value.
Do you have a phone conversation with him? In reference to where he might be?
Not that I can recall.
Okay. Is it fair to say you don't have any memory about any conversation you had with Mark Gooch on the 18th of January?
I would say that's fair.
Would it also be fair to say that you had the most conversation you'd ever had during that year and a half period with him on the 18th of January?
Only in the context of phone calls, not in the context of other forms of communication.
Other forms being?
Talking over the computer. We would talk quite extensively for hours a week.
All right. So fair to say he wasn't on the computer during that day, right?
Based on the phone calls, correct.
Prosecutor Barker showed him a group text message that took place on March 14th, 2020, almost a month after Sasha's murder. The participants in the text message were Mark, Sam, and their older brother, Jake. Jake, a police officer, texted, "Just gave a Mennonite a ticket." Mark responded, "Fuck yes, I hope you treated him like shit. Sam wrote, ha ha, hell yeah. Tell them the state police doesn't like cultists. Jake responded, I did, LOL. Mark wrote, ha ha, fuck yeah. Jake then wrote, I coughed on him so he would spread corona to the wedding they're going to, LOL. Mark wrote, ha ha, that's fucking hilarious. Is it a ticket that he has to appear in court? Jake responded, yep, it's reckless. Mark said, oh yes. Prosecutor Barker asked Sam if he believed that Mennonites were cultists, and he said no. That was part of the banter and was taken too far, he said. He was asked if he knows how to remotely wipe a phone, and he said yes.
After his arrest, did Mark ask you to remotely wipe his phone?
Yes, I believe so.
And not just his phone, but the SD cards as well?
Based on the transcripts, that is correct.
You remember when that conversation occurred?
I believe it was shortly or within a few days of his arrest.
He was asked if he attempted to clean out Mark's Google account, and he said no. They only had conversations about accessing his accounts to cancel any bills. That was in the same conversation where Mark asked him to wipe his phone. Adrian Morales is from the Office of Special Investigations. He explained that it's a Department of Defense agency assigned to the Air Force. Morales is a special agent at Luke Air Force Base. He testified about what he found in the history of Mark's phone browser. On January 28th and January 29th, 2020, about 2 weeks after the murder, Mark searched for the Farmington Police Department Facebook page. On February 2nd, Mark looked at the San Juan County Sheriff's Office Facebook page, specifically at the article about missing Sasha Krause. Then, on February 21st, he searched the Farmington Police Department Facebook page again, this time specifically looking at the article requesting information about Sasha. And also on that same day, he searched again for the San Juan County Sheriff's Office Facebook page. Morales said he also recovered a photo Mark had sent from his phone on the day of the murder, along Route I-17, on the way to Flagstaff. He testified that there was surveillance video that was also retrieved from Mark's dorm. Mark was seen leaving his base and beginning his drive at 9:04 a.m. The next day, surveillance video showed him returning to the base at 6:55 a.m. At 12:44 p.m., he can be seen walking through a base parking lot, carrying a black garbage bag in his right hand. Morales said he was walking towards a secondary parking lot where there are multiple dumpsters. Mark's father, Jim Gooch, testified about where Mark got his rifle.
We've had testimony that Mark received from you sometime associated with maybe the move, a .22 rifle that you had.
Correct.
Tell us about that rifle.
I bought it in the same year Mark was born, 1990. And in the, basically, I quit farming due to a farm accident where I got crushed between a bale and the tractor. I ended up, we had to, needless to say, discard a lot of things, and I gave Mark that rifle.
Why'd you have the rifle?
I bought it. Well, basically, we always have pests on farms. We shoot rats and birds after my feed. So that's, you know, we had that on there.
It was that rifle that was sent to the Arizona State Lab for processing. Forensic scientist and ballistics and firearms specialist Lisa Peloza was called to the stand to talk about it. She has worked on thousands of cases since the beginning of her career.
Does experience matter?
Yes, it does.
More experience, the better in your profession?
I would say so. And I just recently thought of an analogy to explain that better. Prior to being released to do casework, I must take a competency test in addition to those proficiency tests that I take annually. And if you want to compare that to something, we're probably all familiar with. When you get your driver's license, you need to take a test, a road test and a written test, and you need to prove that you're competent to operate a vehicle. And generally speaking, you know how to do that, and you can drive, and you're able to do that successfully. However, the more years you drive and the different surfaces you drive on, the different weather conditions, all those things that you experience in your driving span make you a better driver so that you understand different things. You're able to handle the vehicle better. You understand what could come at you as with surface of a road or, as I stated, the weather. So as time goes on, I would say the more you drive, the better you become. And just like with the microscope work, the more I see, the more I experience, the different types of things that I see, I believe make me a better examiner.
Pelosa said she was able to conclude that Mark's rifle that his father had given him was indeed the gun that had shot Sasha Kraus.
And I think you had already talked about you had fired test rounds through that rifle. Is that true?
Yes, I did test firing of that firearm.
And the class characteristics, I think we were just on that topic before lunch. Tell us about that.
That's right. When I examined the firearm, I saw that it was a .22 long rifle caliber rifle, and the rifling in that barrel was 16 right. 16 lands and grooves with the right-hand twist.
And that was consistent with the test bullet you had examined a couple months prior.
I believe you mean with the evidence bullet, but yes,
I'm
it
sorry.
Was.
Sorry. Yeah, the evidence bullet. Thank you.
I was able to determine that the rifle, item 44, did fire the bullet, item 32.
And was that later verified? That identification, was it verified in your lab?
Yes, it was verified by one of my coworkers.
And confirmed the same thing?
Yes, he did confirm that it was an identification that I had made.
But on cross, the defense had questions about the science and subjectivity of Lisa Pelosa's findings. On direct, she had said that her results had never been previously inconsistent with any other expert's conclusions. She had never had her finalized work be questioned. Mark's attorney brought up her work on the freeway shooter case in Phoenix, Arizona, when Lee Merritt Jr. was initially charged and then later released after the charges against him were dismissed. He pointed out that Pelosa wasn't the primary examiner who made a determination about what gun was fired, but that she was called in to testify about the work of someone else in her office.
Let's just talk about, did you or did you not look at the results and verify the results of your office?
Didn't necessarily verify them because the primary examiner had medical issues. I wanted to look at the evidence and the reports and be able to provide additional information or additional documentation to aid our higher up command to show them what the primary examiner did, why he did it, and explain how he came to those conclusions.
The primary examiner was Christopher Kalkowski, was it not?
Yes.
Did you ever issue an opinion that said that Mr. Kalkowski was wrong?
I did not.
In other words, you backed up his conclusion, did you not?
I can't say I backed up his conclusion. When I looked at the evidence for myself, what I saw looking at the evidence as well as the test fires with the comparison microscope, in my opinion, I did come to the same conclusion.
How's that different than a verification?
A verification would be after the original examiner does their work, then the verifier will come in and verify that what the examiner said is correct. There was no question as to, I was not verifying anything that had already been done. I was just basically reproducing it so that if Mr. Kalkowski, for some reason, couldn't testify or couldn't do any further work on that case, that I would be basically up to par and be able to speak in my own words instead of saying, based on Mr. Kalkowski's analysis, and instead of reading from his notes and report, because it was such a big case, I felt it was important that I knew firsthand what he knew firsthand so that I could speak with my own words and my own opinions and not just have to refer to what had been done.
Pelosa maintained that she was not backing up what her colleague had concluded in that case.
You don't disagree with me that multiple other experts were called to review and examine conclusions that Kalkowski and you reached. Isn't that true?
I am aware of that. I believe those were done prior to my having looked at it. So at that point, it would have been Mr. Kalkowski's work.
Right. So, but you're inextricably linked to Kalkowski's work because you independently examined and agreed to it. You're prepared to back him up. If he died in a car wreck Tuesday, you would have come in and given your opinion, right?
Again, I wouldn't say backing him up. Based on the work that I did, I would have the same result and the same conclusion as he had already stated. Yes.
In my interview with you, I asked you, did I not, about this topic, and you indicated to me, I've not been in a position where I've had anyone disagree with my work. You recall that?
Yes.
Right. Well, this is that situation, is it not? Because isn't it true that more than one expert, not just one expert, but more than one expert disagreed with the conclusion you reached?
At the time the other experts had looked at the evidence and looked at Mr. Kalkowski's work, I had not seen any of the evidence firsthand working on it for myself. So at the time they made their conclusions, I had not been involved in that case as far as literally working it. I had just been present in the lab when Mr. Kalkowski worked it, and I knew what was going on. So at that point, I could say that no one had disagreed with me because I hadn't done anything yet in that case.
But you know that now that there is a disagreement between your conclusion and conclusions reached by other experts, do you not?
Their conclusion was different, but I can't say that they stated that Mr. Kalkowski did anything wrong or then in turn that I had done anything wrong.
He also asked her to name an authoritative source in the field whom she looked up to and respected.
And one of those people was Lucien Haig, was it not?
Yes.
One of the people that disagreed with your findings in the Leslie Merritt case was Lucien Haig, the person that you indicate top shelf guy, right?
In different areas, in different parts of firearm identification, I still have high regards for him. When it comes to microscopic work, I would not feel as comfortable with his work on the microscope as someone that I know that's been doing it regularly, more day-to-day and on a regular basis.
So when you told me you had high respect for his work, you didn't condition it on something else. You didn't know at that point in time that I'd researched the Leslie Merritt case and knew what I knew, right?
Correct.
While Lisa Pelosa told the court she was certain that Mark's .22 caliber rifle was the gun used to shoot Sasha, the defense brought in an expert who didn't agree. It would be a battle of the experts. Forensic scientist Eric Warren examined the bullet that was used to kill Sasha. He also examined Mark's rifle. He brought in a slideshow with pictures to show the jury, something the defense team pointed out that Lisa Pelosa did not do. Warren walked the jury through his process. He tested the items himself. Then he compared them to the Arizona State Crime Lab's results.
And because I was submitted Arizona's test fires, I then also looked at those to make sure that mine matched up with theirs, as they should, because what I was told was that these were test fires from that Marlin rifle as well.
After examining everything, he said he wanted to try to match what the crime lab had found, but he noticed differences.
After I examined my test fires together and saw the type of agreement that I showed with all those individual characteristics lining up, I compared it to the evidence bullet. And I did not see the same correspondence. And so in order to, as I stated yesterday, I tried to approach this as if it had never been worked before. I was the first person working it. And when I saw that there was that lack of correspondence, knowing the conclusion of the Arizona DPS examiner, I kind of shifted my focus at that point. Having a colleague in the field, you don't want to speak badly of them or tell them that your opinion is differing. So I shifted my focus and decided that that I was going to basically try to prove that she was correct.
But ultimately, he concluded that the bullets did not match Mark Gooch's rifle.
At most, I could find one, two things per area that matched up, but it all appeared to be more of the random in nature and not the type of individual characteristics matching that I would call an identification. At the conclusion, I'm showing, again, basically, due to randomness, there might be one or two of these stria or scratches that match, but in general, there are overwhelmingly more differences than similarities. And so the conclusion that I have to reach is that the rifle, at least in its current condition that was given to me, did not produce those same stria to match that of the evidence bullet.
Both firearm experts had explained to the jury that there are three categories when trying to identify the correct firearm used in a crime: a match, inconclusive, and ruled out. Warren's direct examination was worded as though he had ruled out Mark's weapon. The prosecution asked for clarification.
Let's just be clear about your conclusion. It's inconclusive, is your conclusion, right?
That is correct. It would be what's called by AFTI as an inconclusive.
You're not eliminating this bullet from being fired from item 44, right?
Correct, only because I do not know what condition this firearm would have been in if it were the correct firearm at the time it was fired.
Right. So we know that, and we've heard this before, but there are a number of conclusions as a firearm examiner you can make, right? One of them is an identification, which we've talked about. We just talked about elimination. Then there's the middle area, inconclusive, right?
That is correct, yes.
And that's where you're at on this case.
That is correct.
Prosecutor Barker also asked how much he was being paid for his work on the case.
How much are you being paid to be here, sir?
$250 per hour.
And so you get paid for your testimony beyond the lab work, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Would it be weird to, and wouldn't it show some level of bias if the examiner were to tweak a report to satisfy the requesting agency?
Yes.
But that's what you did in this case, right? Or you offered to do in this case?
No.
Sir, you emailed defense counsel and said, I'm happy to tweak and change it to your liking, the report. Isn't that what you said?
Yes, and that was referring to typos or anything like that.
That's not what you said. You said, I'm happy to tweak and change it to your liking.
Yes.
Period.
I mean, at that point, my conclusions were already solidified. The only thing that would need to be tweaked or changed is any type of typographical error or anything like that.
That's not what you said, right?
Yes.
Thank you.
The jury was allowed to ask questions of the witnesses, and one particular question that was of interest was asked of Eric Warren. He was asked if the bullet that was taken from Sasha's body matched the ammunition taken from the gun when it was seized from Mark Gooch. He said no. In his closing arguments, Prosecutor Barker told the jury again what had happened to Sasha.
Picture in your mind what this must have looked like. Sasha being marched from the car, hit in the back of the head, crumpled to the ground. Then it shoots her in the back of the head with this .22 caliber rifle. And leaves her in the dirt, face down, where she wouldn't be discovered for weeks later.
He brought up the differences in the experts' testimonies.
The defense expert isn't excluding that bullet. He's inconclusive. Lisa Pelosa, state's expert, says the defendant's rifle fired this bullet. So there's somewhat of a dispute here. Let's talk about the differences in their testimony and their experience. Lisa Pelosa, 25 plus years of experience, thousands of cases under her belt. The state expert. She doesn't get a bonus, doesn't get an extra paycheck if she finds a comparison, makes that identification. There's no stakes for her. She sees it, calls it how she sees it. Defendant's expert, 12 years of experience. Remember how I asked him about if experience matters? It didn't matter as much to him, right, because he didn't have as much experience. 1,300 cases, according to him, at TBI, which is the state-run facility he was at before he went private. And he's a professional witness. He gets paid to testify.
He told the court how Mark had tried to cover up his crime by asking a friend to hold on to the tools in his car for him and by getting his car washed and detailed. He then read off more text messages between Mark and his brother Sam as Mark was having his car cleaned.
So he went to the car service and he got every interior detail service you can get. And during that time, he's texting with Sam Gooch, the person who came in to testify in this court and tried to cover up for his brother. I'm getting my car done right now. Sam, where'd you put your tools? Buddy's truck with topper. Sam, could always spray down with disinfectant spray when they're done too. A strange thing to suggest. Defend, they're doing fine detail shampoo and steam clean.
In case that was hard to hear, I will recap that right now. After Mark says that he was getting his car cleaned, Sam suggested spraying it down with disinfectant spray when they're done too. What a strange thing to suggest, Prosecutor Barker said. After that, Mark replied that they're doing fine detail shampoo and steam clean. Barker said steam and heat kills DNA, and so does bleach. He said that same day, Mark went out and bought liquid bleach. He told the jury that after Mark couldn't get his friend to take the tools and the gun from his car, he took it to another friend's house, off base, and left it there. As for motive, Prosecutor Barker said that although Mark didn't appear to personally know Sasha, he was familiar with and had resentment towards the Mennonite Church. He pointed to the text exchange between Mark and his brothers about his brother Jake having pulled over a Mennonite.
This is not the exchange someone has when they love Mennonites, when they want to attend a Mennonite church. This is someone who is relishing in the pain and suffering of another Mennonite, someone he doesn't even know. It's like Sasha.
In his closing arguments, attorney Bruce Griffin told the jury that none of the evidence the prosecution presented was fact. He argued against the cell phone records, saying the locations weren't certain. And as for the text messages prosecutors said Mark exchanged with his brother Sam, he said they didn't have the context in which the state implied. Aside from that, he pointed to testimony from their expert, Eric Warren.
What did Mr. Warren tell you that was so crucial and it came about in such a great way that and I'm not sure that it landed on everybody. Appreciate this. The evidence bullet, the smashed bullet, the damaged bullet, the recovered bullet from the autopsy did not come from the seized ammunition when the gun was recovered. Holy smoke. Why don't we hear about that from the state? We focused all our time on the gun, and we almost blew by the bullet. The bullet doesn't match the ammo, guys. It's unrebutted, undisputed, and it is absolutely, positively, reasonable doubt number one.
Griffin also delved into the prosecution's theory of motive.
The state's worked hard to try to suggest to you that there is motive in this case because of two text message scenarios over a four-year period that have some relationship to a Mennonite topic. Wouldn't you think it would be just the opposite, that there would be bunches and bunches and bunches of references to Mennonites and hating Mennonites and spewing vile and making plans if that was the intent here? That's not the situation. The situation is that there are two explainable situations regarding reference to Mennonites that the state has stretched beyond capacity to try to establish motive because there's no connection between Sasha and Mr. Gooch.
Griffin then turned his closing arguments back to the firearm evidence, urging the jury to concentrate on Eric Warren's findings and not Lisa Pelosa's.
So, is it reasonable doubt that the evidence that was seized from Gooch is not the evidence that resulted in a bullet that killed Sasha Krause? It's a huge issue. You know it. And you also know that the gun doesn't match Now, counsel's quick to point out, well, that doesn't mean it can be completely excluded. But you know, unrebutted, no rebuttal here, millions of Marlins, guys, millions of Marlins. But there's no effort here to do any better than that. So all we can tell you is you can look at the exhibits. We brought them to you. If you could match up the evidence bullet with any test fire, you're Lisa Pelosi. Reasonable doubt is established by the bullet not connecting to this case from the evidence that was seized, and that the gun cannot be taken as the weapon that made this shot.
He said the jury had more than enough reasonable doubt to find Mark not guilty. After 5.5 hours of deliberation, the jury reached their verdict. Mark Gooch was guilty of all charges. Mark is currently awaiting sentencing as of this recording and is facing up to life in prison. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts about this case. Join the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, tweet me at Court Junkie Pod, or you can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This case was researched and written by Polly Katowski with additions by me. Follow Polly on Instagram at Polly Katowski. To hear these episodes without the ads and to hear additional Court Junkie bonus episodes, check out my Patreon options at courtjunkie.com/support. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.